This is Scott Allen from odedecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
This is Scott Allen, and we're happy to bring this show to you from the lobby of the Westin at the MVP Summit of 2009.
Okay, my name is Ben Sherman. I'm an in-hibernate enthusiast, and I just had some questions for people who are maybe on the other side of the camp. Or...
And I'm Oren, also known as Andrain, and recently known as Bill for a reason that I'm not going to disclose at this point in time.
And my name is David Pinson. I am the performance lead at Telligent Systems.
Yeah, so now Ben has some questions.
We got on the topic of in-hibernate, and there was some heated discussion. And I just wanted to ask the question of, as an experienced SQL performance person, what is your opinion of in-hibernate?
Okay, so short version. I'll try to keep this concise. I will be as specific as possible, but use the least amount of time as possible. Because this is the second time we're recording. So, first and foremost, and I'll be very clear about this, I think that that in Hibernate, that there are some very good things that in Hibernate has to offer. And, where I am concerned about are the types of queries that could either potentially be generated or, you know, either by in Hibernate, of course, on the same side, from other, let's just say developers that have some experience in SQL that are perhaps not as performant in that. Let's just, you know, say that. Did you want to say something else, Ben?
Sure. I mean, that's kind of irrelevant because you have the same problem with SQL developers.
Okay, fair enough. But if you're using a tool to generate your SQL, for the most part, they're going to try to use the tool to begin with to make it as easy as possible. You know, and if they see some errors, you know, or some issues, let's just say, then they, you know, will try something, of course. But to your point, we'll just say, let's pretend that we're not doing anything special, right? Then we're not overriding any behavior, right? The kind of things that I'd like to see, first off, something I had brought up to Oren before is in the case of varying length parameters on in Hibernate, where it could perhaps generate multiple query plans for logically the same query based upon size. He said that is potentially a bug, and I'll definitely give him that. And
I still don't know what you mean by that.
Okay.
I realize that two very similar queries with different parameters could result in completely different query plan caches, right?
Sure.
Okay, so when does that manifest itself?
Okay, so if you have a query that is submitted, let's take, for instance, a very simple case, invarchar 20. Yeah, an invarchar 20 variable. All right, so if a string gets passed in that's invarchar 11, or in other words, the length of the string is 11, but the actual type of the column is 20. So if that query gets passed in first and the parameter is set to invarchar 11, then you have a query plan cache that includes the parameter size invarchar 11. All right. So if a string length 15 gets passed in, then you have two particular query plan caches that is submitted in the SQL server. So, now that is definitely a performance issue. It can be a performance issue, especially in a highly used system. So if that's a bug, sure, I'd love to make sure that that's taken care of. The other concern that I have would be, you know, whether or not a correlated subquery would be used over something that perhaps could be better served as an exist clause, or even perhaps a, you know, some sort of an outer join. And when I say outer join, I mean specifically as in like a left or a right or a full outer join, because anytime that an ANSI join is used, you should fully qualify that. Now, Oren has told me that there are definitely conditions where things will happen like that. Okay, Oren would like to expand on that particular point.
Okay, so I want to touch about a couple of the topics that you actually talked about. One of them was about the concern regarding the different query plans for different actual parameter size. And to the best of my knowledge, even though I don't have the entire in-hibernate codebase in my head, we don't actually have this problem. I know that other ORM products have had this problem and are working on fixing that. But I don't believe that Enable has that because I remember looking at that. It may be the case. If it is the case, then this is a bug and it's fairly easy to fix that. So that is one concern that I don't believe that you should have. Worst case scenario, you have to ping me and then I would have to do some late network. Now, yeah.
I would be happy to assist. Being a DBA and also being extremely, I would like to think extremely active in the community and at least discussing the issues. I would definitely be very apt to, reviewing any of that, doing any of that work, dealing with that in any way, shape, or form to be able to ensure that things are more appropriate because I know from a specific DBA standpoint, some DBAs might not be as interested in dealing with this particular issue or any issue as that because they would be more apt to thinking about everything that comes from the TDS stream all the way to the database and nothing else, which I believe is kind of that they should be more concerned about that. And there should be other things that are happening. So I, as a DBA, as a concerned DBA would like to ensure that those things are handled and taken care of.
Okay, so you mentioned that Hibernate does a lot of good things, and especially in the simple cases, it's easy. It's a slam dunk. I mean, all those queries are fine, and they couldn't get any better. In the other cases where some work might be needed to make things a little bit better, like we mentioned on the first recording, you can, in those cases, substitute your own handcrafted SQL to cover those. And in my experience, I mean, I haven't ever had to do that, but I realize that those situations do exist. So, I mean, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater in the case of some small percentage. And that term is kind of relative, I guess, to the application. But, I think that we can address both problems.
First thing that I want to say, I really appreciate your being willing and able to come in and help us investigate any sort of problem that we have with Enable8. And certainly, as your role as performance lead, being able to do any sort of performance improvement on Enable8 is something that is very dear and near to my heart because it would directly affect my own life. So, thank you very much for that. Regarding the specific scenarios that you raise, again, I'm not going to touch the query cache issue. I think it's not an issue. But you said something before, again, the previous recording, and I want you to explain to me what are the types of queries that you have in your application and what are the impact of each type on the actual application.
Okay, so there are a couple of cases that I can explain and discuss in this. Now, for one thing, a simple case would be if you have a correlated subquery in an in clause within a where predicate. Okay.
So, I'm actually more interested in understanding how much trivial queries do you have in the application and how much queries you have that you yourself, as a perf lead or someone in the perf team, needs to take personal interest in and maybe write an additional index, maybe add some query hints. And what is the impact of these different types of the queries on the actual application and the end result in the application performance?
Okay, that's a very good point, Oren, and the way I would approach that is such. So let's suppose that you have an application that has, let's just say 500 stored procedures, okay? Now, out of the 500 stored procedures, there's definitely there are definitely metrics for the number of times that those stored procedures are called within the lifetime of the application over time. Okay, so let's just take, for instance, out of those 500 stored procedures, 95% of those stored procedures, 90 or 95%, it really doesn't matter at this point, but let's say some percentage, a large percentage, are only called very few times. And then you have some stored procedures, a few stored procedures, perhaps 5%, perhaps 10%, that are called quite a few times. A very common scenario for something like this would be in some sort of a reporting application where you could have a lot of different parameters that are passed or different styles of parameters that are passed. The styles of parameters could be an in clause in a where statement or a where clause, which I called a predicate earlier, which is just kind of a fancy way of saying, where clause, right? But typically in the DBA world, you call it a predicate. All right. So that's one consideration for that. And one thing that I would like to see that would be ensured that would be something that's handled. All right. And because I consider it to be much more of a best practice in terms of writing appropriate SQL statements and really in any of the disciplines, SQL Server, DB2 or Oracle, and perhaps, you know, many others. Now, another case that I've seen that, you know, that is often abused, let's say, where, well, and you laugh and I think you'll know where I'm coming from when I say this. So people will write a select statement and then in the select clause, they'll write a correlated subquery to get some value.
Just all to right. Give the listener that an idea, that means that you have a query running per each row in the result set.
Exactly.
So I think it's called a result function, a row set function or something like that.
It could be. There's several different names for that.
And that's right. Usually a bad thing.
That's just the nicest name.
That's right,
yeah.
Correct. That's
the nicest there is name, also right. the I'm being stupid. A name for that.
Okay, that's a very good point. But in terms of business requirements, you know, for a developer, for us to say it's stupid, that absolutely, that's definitely something to think about. But then again, from a business requirement standpoint, it's if it's something that the business needs, then that's something that, you know, we should strive to ensure that it's as performant as possible. Okay, I think we can all agree on that. So let's take the case where, you know, you might have one column that has that. Okay, so there's going to be some row set operations on that. Where I'd say even on one column, the thing that would be more appropriate in that case would be a derived query, or should I say a derived view, where that iteration example would be done one time and then joined to the outer query, or, you know, whichever that query would be. And to me, that would be a much more performant way of dealing with a situation like that. And not only what that does, it shows the example that says, okay, here's how I'm doing this for this particular example. And then when the next business requirement comes in, it says, I need to look at a different particular subset of query, a different particular subset of data for that, that this is the pattern.
The same way.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. I want to see the same pattern for this, because what I end up doing is in the non-performant way, what I'm looking at is basically a for loop that is within a for loop. Exactly. And yes. I think for the most part, we can all agree that there's definitely problems with that. If you can reduce that to something much more performant where you're looking at, a much tighter for loop that is joined in, let's say, some sort of perhaps an inner loop join or a hash join, something like that, something that would be considered to be a more appropriate join strategy in SQL Server, would be something that would be more appropriate for that case. And like I said before, would definitely be a much more appropriate example for developers to follow in the future for that.
Okay, so let me try to see how many of your concerns I can address, at least as many as I can remember. So one of the things that Hibernate is doing is predictability. And Hibernate, in the same set of scenarios, will always generate the same SQL. Because the assumption is that the worst thing that we could possibly do is to try to be overly smart. Okay, if we are being overly smart, then basically in production, bad thing will happen when the set of assumption is no longer valid. So in here, we've been very conservative. If it run on your development machine, it's exactly the same thing that will run on your production machine. So it's very easy to do the comparison from the development to production and do the review about whatever is going to happen.
Okay, now that's a great point, Oren. Now, what I'd say to that, this is from the perspective of testing. I see more developers than, let's just say, probably 95, 98, 99% of developers. When they're doing things in development, they're looking at perhaps 5% of the data that they should be, maybe even less. Maybe even much less. And I consider that to be, well, that's a failure from a different standpoint. Okay. It really is. Yeah. And for me, the volume standpoint is extremely important, because, you know, when you're looking at, you know, data in a table that's, you know, 1,000 records or even 10,000 records, you know, SQL Server will choose it will choose a totally different query plan. And it's dangerous. I don't fault in Hibernate for that at all. Not one bit. I definitely fault the query processor of SQL Server or Oracle for something like that.
It actually makes sense from the point of view of me as the author of the query processor. I want to give it the best answer possible. And depending on the volume of data in the table, I will make different strategies for that. I do want to address something that is related to that. Another concern that you have that in production that doesn't exist in testing or in development mode is concurrency. If you have a query that locks the table, it may be extremely fast to execute, but it's going to kill your application in production. So that's another issue that you have to consider when you actually build a system that goes to production. And Ben, you want to say something?
So you mentioned that regardless of what tool you're using, a vast majority, like, you know, 99% of developers, you know, 88% of stats are made up. But
I'm agree.
I totally agree. Yeah, I'm just saying that the vast majority of developers aren't going to know, and they're going to do what they do, and it's not going to be right. And 9 times out of 10, it probably doesn't matter anyway. But on the systems where it does matter, the tools you use, one, they should encourage you to do the right thing and make it kind of hard to do the wrong things. So in your opinion, how easy is it to do the wrong thing in raw SQL? You know, and I think Oren and I could probably speak to how easy it is to do the wrong thing in Hibernated. Unfortunately, I think it's fairly easy. But I want to hear from the SQL perspective, you know, kind of like pit of success type of comment.
Okay, that's a great point, Ben. Now, the way I would approach that is that over the years, and I'll say my first experience with SQL Server was SQL 6.5. My first experience with Oracle was Oracle 7.3 and DB2, I want to say version 7. And of course, you know, DB2 has quite a bit more years between the years on definitely understands that. So I certainly will not say that I think it's the fault of the SQL that something like in Hibernate might generate, or even that a developer might generate. Now, I will definitely put some blame on the query processor for not understanding the things that should be understood. And I'll say from the perspective of set theory, that certain things within set theory, you would expect to work the same way with a smaller size set versus a larger size set. Okay? Now, from a mathematical standpoint, that's the way I would see that. Okay? Now, from a SQL standpoint, from a coding standpoint within the query optimizer, then that's perhaps not the same thing.
I think that what you're saying here is that for a small subset, the critical subset of your application, there is a lot of specialized knowledge that you have to have. Thing that most developers we not necessarily see, because, and I'm pretty sure that I'm right, most of your knowledge about what works and what doesn't work come from having things not work in production. Am I correct?
That's I would definitely agree with that statement. Okay. And not only that, too, something that is performant, you know, or let's just say a specific type of statement that might be performant in SQL Server might not be performant in Oracle and might not be performant in DB2. Very specific standpoint from that is if I have an exist query that has multiple queries that are, let's just say, union all versus a query within DB2 that would be a branched logic and that would take the same type of paths. Two totally different designs of queries that get me the same results in performance that would not necessarily be known to some tool like InHibernate. That's not the fault of InHibernate. That's the fault of the SQL.
I actually think that here you make a mistake in assuming that InHibernate will not make that distinction, because InHibernate actually work, I think, now on 10 to 15 to 20 different databases. And when we are talking about the type of queries that we generate, I'm not going to generate the same query for Oracle as I would be for SQL, because inhabit, codify a lot of that exact knowledge that you're talking about, that hard experience of something has failed in production, and now we need to figure out what's going on, and it's different in Oracle, it's different in DB2. All of that is already been, to a large extent, already written into inhabit. So you're probably going to see those type of operation already, so you already can take advantage of them by not basically just using habit and not doing anything else, and you're able to get that.
Okay, that's a great point, but the way I'd say that is, as a DBA, I feel like that I cannot just accept at face value that would happen. But I would definitely give it to you that it could definitely have the ability to do that, but I can't take it at face value that it will happen. Okay. So, I mean, I think it's a distinction. Okay. It's a distinction that I would definitely give you if you know where I'm coming from there.
Yes. And so I think that I'm absolutely in agreement. You care about that part of performance. That's your job, basically. And as such, you want to personally, not only just we use this tool, so it's probably we fine and we fix this if it's not fine. That is not a responsible thing to do, because I'm going to see what are the most common queries that I have. And I'm going to optimize them. And Inhabit is already giving me a lot of tools to try to optimize the query and to change the way that Inhabit is going to perform a query within the realm of Inhabit itself. However, Inhabit cannot do everything. There's a limit of what even Inhabit can do. So there is this tiny escape clause in which you can say, you know what? I'm smarter than Inhabit in this case. I know I have the context. Maybe I will fix Inhabit later, but right now I need to fix this problem. So you can actually go to Inhabit and tell it, dear Inhabit, whenever you see this query, I want you to use this particular, what? I have people laughing in here, and Inhabit is very dear and near to my heart. So if you want to keep good relations with Inhabit, you could it. Deal, you call it honey, you could have just do the bloody thing.
Actually, Orin, can't you just call it Inhibi?
No, because that for me it's bring to mind inhibitations. So probably not. So anyway, you can go to Inhabit and tell it, whenever you see this query, I want you to execute this SQL, which was hand optimized. I approve that. It works for my scenarios. You can even say, you know what? I want this query to run for SQL Server, this for Oracle, and this for DB2, because I sat down and I paid a whole bunch of attention to the actual performance semantics in this database, in these queries. So that would be a great way of actually solving this problem of I need to have all of that control and I still want to use Inhabit. The advantage of using Inhabit in this case is that most of the time, 95% of the time, you don't care. So having a tool that actually deal with the 95% of the cases, but leaves you the option, how do I handle that last 5% in a very easy way, in a way that actually have very big separation between what the DBA is doing and what the developer is doing, is a thing of a great value.
So about 10 minutes ago, we made a comment about specific optimizations per database platform, right? And in some cases, yeah, that's part of the domain of Inhibernate to know about that thing, and whatever vendor you're on, it's going to use what it knows is the correct way to execute specific pieces of SQL. Now, that said, most of the people just use SQL Server, and so that's where, like, most of the performance,
I wouldn't say so.
Okay, I'm going to make my personal opinion and say,
Your experience has been mostly on SQL Server.
No, all. Mine, personally, is all on SQL Server. But even most of the people I see on the mailing list. Even still, sometimes you find, on the mailing list, they'll come across some user using Firebird, and they say, when I do this, it doesn't work. Right? And that's a bug, like, it doesn't work at all. That's, like, easy to report. When you find somebody like yourself, Dave, who can examine what's going on and say, dear Orin, in this case on this vendor, Inhibernate should really do it this way. It requires people like you. I mean, this is an open source project. It requires that type of knowledge to surface. And frankly, most people don't spend that much time doing it. I mean, they're just going to say, oh, this is stupid. And they're going to, you know, kick it to the curb, you know, because of those things. But the people who use the application on those vendors, those are the ones that are going to get the most attention.
Okay, now, one thing I'd say to that is, I really would love to make sure that I can, that I figure out within my schedule to ensure that I can deal with that. It's definitely something that's very important to me, and not necessarily, I'll speak generically, not necessarily from an in-Hibernate standpoint, but just from a database performance standpoint. I really feel deeply about the ability for developers to make sure that they're doing the best thing that they can performance-wise on things. And, of course, I mean, that's near and dear to me since that is something that I have to look at on a daily basis. Yeah, so.
So, normally when people complain about in-Hibernate performance, I mean, I have a lot of experience with people complaining about in-Hibernate specifically. And it's always about misunderstanding about how it works. In the same case where you misunderstand how the database works, you're going to do something stupid. And, I mean, in one case where you have a gigantic object graph where you've mapped one to many's all the way over, so you've got a parent-child relationship, right? Like a person who has a manager, and that manager has a manager, and that manager has a manager. And likewise, they've got, you know, subordinates, which is a collection of people, right? And so, you know, if you... Yes, I'm a good object modeler, and I've modeled that relationship to a T, and now I'm going to select one person from the database, you know, and without lazy loading. And, you know, how many queries is that? It could be a lot, you know what I mean?
A lot being 10,000.
Yes, but...
Per page load, okay? I just want to make this clear. 10,000 queries per page load. I'm going to assume that if I have a query that generates 10,000 page loads, you're going to be unhappy.
Absolutely. And I see things that are like that all the time. It's a basic N plus one problem. It's a basic N plus one problem. It depends on a lot of factors because it depends on where, you know, where that duplication comes from within that call. What that really says though, that's not necessarily the problem of SQL. It's not necessarily in SQL from a general standpoint.
This is a problem with the developer not understanding that going to SQL is an expensive operation.
But exactly. But the thing is that they probably, I would bet money on it that it's highly likely they just don't realize it. All right. And of course, why don't they realize it? Because they're not using specific profiling tools to be able to see what is happening.
It works on their machine
and it works with the data set that they have, right? And their data set might be extremely small, which when you put it in a production environment, you know, that could be 100 times it drops down. So then what you end up having is a developer that's not using, let's say if they're using in Hibernate, they're not using an HProf. Or they're not using a SQL Query Analyzer, or a SQL Profiler for something like that. And in my opinion, and what I would say in the experience that I have, a developer that is using a database, I don't care what database it is, if you're not using a profiler while developing your application, you are not doing your job. You know, absolutely. And that's an extremely valid point for anyone that's a developer that connects to any database, even if it's Access, because guess what? You can profile Access also. Okay. You sure can, even if you don't know that.
As long as it's only one user at a time.
You have up to 5 users.
So if you're profiling the production database, then you might lock out all the other users. But on the same token, a developer did that within Hibernate, and I actually profiled the startup cost was 900 something queries. And that was to fill a drop down list of cranes in a port. I mean, it was that bad, right? You know, you don't notice it when there's almost no data. I mean, I can load an entire object graph, almost half the database, and I don't notice it. I mean, it's actually pretty fast. But then, you know, this was like a year after this. They're starting to see problems with startup costs and some of the other operations. So we started doing some actual domain modeling and say, you know what? You never navigate from this object to this one, right? At the root level, if I just want to pull those objects out with a query rather than object traversal, well, yeah. And they're like, yeah, we never do that. So I said, well, get rid of the collection, right? I don't need a reference to my parent if I'm never going to navigate to it. I mean, just that one, you know, take some scissors and snip the UML diagram, and it reduced it down to like 45 queries, right? And so we could actually apply that pattern in more than one place. And I think that was a big win within Hibernate. And there's still lots of problems due to that type of development all throughout the system. But in a day, I was able to go in there and say, yeah, snip. And startup costs went from 30 seconds to 2 seconds, right? And I think that's a positive thing for a framework that lets, you know, when you do understand it, it's when you do understand how to use it, you can actually make quick wins. Okay, Scott?
So, Oren and Ben, out of the people that you've met on the mailing list and people that have problems within Hibernate, how many of them would you say ran into problems because they were trying to find that magic tool so that they didn't have to give any respect to the database, so that they thought they wouldn't never have to think about it?
That's a problematic question, because the question that I would like to give is probably offensive. And I probably shouldn't have said that anyway. But no, let me try to put it in terms that would be more understandable. Any attempt to say, I want a complete abstraction will fail. And Hibernate doesn't give a complete abstraction on top of the database because such an abstraction is not possible.
Now, that type of abstraction is a farce. And not just in a database, but in every aspect, you know, all the way from one end of the client side, all the way to the very back end of the data.
Absolutely. Now, that doesn't mean that such an abstraction isn't useful and that you cannot do a whole bunch of things in that abstraction. But that does mean that you have to understand what the hell is going on. Now, we've talked about, I think that the focus in the beginning of this discussion was about performance, and then we moved a bit for design and a actual development practices about what we're actually going to do. Yeah, so coming back to this question, how many people assume that using a tool will prevent them from the need to think? There are certainly such people, and I think that it can get frustrating at some points to have to answer the same question for the 1500th time. But by the same token, one of the responsibilities is actually to create a community where we are not just, you know, the guy that came in 2004 and are already very well familiar with Hibernate. I mean, 2004 is 5 years ago. I only recently realized that that was the case. I mean, 9.9 minus 4 is 5. And that was a very recent discovery to me. But 5 years of experience in working with Hibernate, and additional 4 or 5 years before that with the Hibernate product, which is where Hibernate came from. So we're talking about almost a decade of hundreds and thousands of people who are actually contributing. I'm not talking about the users. The users are in the tens and the hundreds of millions for Hibernate, for Hibernate alone. And Hibernate right now has something in the order of 20 to 30,000 downloads per month. And this is sustained over a long period of time. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of users, if not more, huge number of websites, high requirements of scalability and performance, and it's been able to manage all of that. So decade of users that are actively contributing to that and keep adding new stuff has huge, broad effect about what you can do. So it also means that Hibernate is a tool that you have to learn in stages. There is the initial stage, I just want to map my objects, and wow, I don't have to write any data access code. Yeah.
That's exactly where I came from. You know, I was like, hey, I hate writing inline SQL and stored procedures for me are a pain. I'd like to not do that anymore. And that's exactly why I adopted an ORM. And that's a wrong reason to adapt an ORM, right? And I think a lot of people...
No, absolutely. That's a good reason to adopt an ORM for a specific scenario.
Well, to pretend the database is not there is the wrong...
Okay. If you want to pretend the database doesn't exist, that will lead to a problem because you're ignoring the fact that calling to the database
is actually very high. It's very highly costly operation. So you are going to probably run into issues if you go to the high scale. If you don't go to the high scale, and if you have a fairly simple application, and by high scale I'm talking about hundreds of users, hundreds of concurrent users, not in a very big demands on you. Maybe you need to scale to multiple machines, maybe you have a single machine, but you have to handle a very high load. At that point, it's going to bite you, especially if you have big amount of data. But for the small scale, you don't really need a lot of information, a lot of knowledge about Hibernate to get a very successful application out.
And that's true. And it just takes a little bit of investment and reading the logs and seeing the profiler so you know exactly what's going on. I mean, there's some professionalism there that you just have to do that. But to answer your question originally, how many people come at it with, I forget how you phrased it, how many people come at it with just want to pretend that SQL doesn't exist? Okay. I think too many is my answer. I mean, like every couple of days you see somebody on the mailing list who, it would be nice if we could just copy and paste some replies from the previous day.
My main frustration is when someone make a request that make absolute no sense when you actually realize what you ask an Hibernate to do. Like, I want an Hibernate to read my mind. I'm sorry, but the psychic model is not developed yet. Now, we start to talk about the stages, and you start by just doing Hibernate mapping, and wow, I have no data access code. And then you move to, okay, what are the all the options that Hibernate gives me to control the way that I access the database, the way that that Hibernate deals with my data. On top of that, there is, okay, now I want to go to the database and I have like Dev has, performance requirement. So I have a very simple solution to read it from the database very, very fast. Can you guess what it is?
Cache.
Don't go to the database. If you don't go to the database, it's insanely fast because the database isn't actually involved. Now, Hibernate is very sophisticated a caching mechanism that basically means you say this is cacheable and this is how this is the cache provider and that's it. Anything else is handled internally by Hibernate. And that scales from a single machine running on a standard ASP.NET cache to a farm or for a large farm which run a distributed caching solution, and Hibernate is aware of that, can actually handle cross machine updates in a very graceful manner. It's not how to deal with all of that. There is actually a new feature. There is a new interface to an existing feature in Hibernate that was recently added, and it's called a feature queries. This is something that is an extension of a feature that already exists called multi-queries, which has the same idea, but is slightly hard to use. So feature queries in Hibernate basically mean the same thing, that I can actually take a set of queries and tell in Hibernate, you see all of these queries? Make them run as a single unit. So we go to the database only once. So that basically means that from my perspective, I just write code normally and have a take a look at what I'm actually doing and do the best to optimize the data access pattern to the database. So we only have to pay the network traversal cost once. So if I'm looking at that, there are levels of knowledge in an Hibernate and how much you need to know about an Hibernate, how deep you have to go into what it can do depending on your actual user scenario. And given all what we said, I would really like to hear what, Dave, you have to say about what you think about an Hibernate now.
So one of the things that I would say with that, you know, to those specific points, is that, well, I mean, first and foremost, I would definitely say, I mean, I definitely need to look more through in Hibernate, but I did say that to begin with, that I felt like I should. Okay, so I mean, I can't necessarily say that my perspective has changed on that. But now one thing that I would definitely say is that from my perspective, I feel like that a lot, you know, there's definitely a lot of DBAs that do not give any merit to any Orium. All right, I know you put your hands up, and I agree with that. And That's definitely a problem. And the reason why I say it's a problem is not from the standpoint of acceptance, but more from the standpoint of being able to adjust and change and grow with technology. And I feel like that perhaps enough of that is not done in the right places in the, let's just say, the SQL administration or SQL database perspective community there. You know, there could definitely be more things done there. And, perhaps, you know, they feel like the perspective is that, you know, they're worried about the SQL engine itself and that's it more so, you know, but from a developer standpoint or really, let's just say from my standpoint, from a performance standpoint, I'm not looking at this just from whether or not this SQL is optimized. Okay. Now, cause you know, when people come to me, they're coming to me with, hey man, my application doesn't work. Okay. I've got all this data in my application and I can't access it. So, you know, what ends up happening is, yes, I can go straight to the database and say, okay, what's happening there? But I cannot afford the luxury to just assume that's only where it is. I think that's kind of the point we were making about before about, you know, developers having, you know, much less data in their development database versus something that would be in a typical production environment or even 1 year or 2 years, 5 years down the road. But, you know, I'll reiterate this that, you know, I believe that, yeah, that in Hibernate, it likely solves, and I'll say likely because I know that there's more research that should be done here, but it likely solves 95% of all the things that need to be done. But the 5% of the things I'm not going to fault in Hibernate with, because where I'd say is that perhaps, I mean, I'm sure that Oren has had plenty of people help him on things. I would definitely lend a hand to ensure that any perspectives I might have would be, you know, attributed to the product. And of course, like I said, you know, I've reviewed this with a couple of other prominent developers in the community and had discussions with them on that. So I'll stop. I'll end this with saying I will pledge to do what I can, for InHibernate and for, the propagation of this type of technology, because developers are going to use it. They're going to use it, and it's pertinent upon SQL developers and SQL DBAs to be able to understand and take this to heart, take this to the core of the database and go with it from there.
And on behalf of the InHibernate project, I want to say that this type of attitude is hugely appreciated.
Usually.
Hugely.
Oh, hugely. Okay. My apologies.
Okay. It would also be usually appreciated unless it was expressed in very offensive terms. But most of the time we can handle even my application broke in how many is at fault. So whatever. Yeah. So I really appreciate your attitude and your willingness to, see the flows that you've seen in the InHibernate currently and help us come and fix them and see how we can make InHibernate a product that is more suited to your needs. And obviously, because if we benefit from your perspective and your knowledge about how we can optimize the application, then anyone who uses InHibernate will benefit from that.
Thank you, Oren.
Gentlemen, I just wanted to thank you. I was a spectator in a very entertaining and informative conversation. I genuinely thank you. It was very good. And I think the second recording actually worked out better.
Yeah. If you lose this, John.
Yeah. Don't lose it.
Okay, take four.
Sam, there is a beep. There is an ATM card here. Sorry, there's an ATM machine here that started beeping. And yes, and now we are really, really hoping. We all of that gathered around it together and it's beeping and we really hope that you would start pushing money. Okay? So, coming back to the InHibernate